The first case for argument is Recording Industry versus Deep. Mr. Montague.
May it please the court, my name is Will Montague and I represent the appellant John Deep in this appeal. What I'm going to discuss today...
Could you keep your voice up, please?
Excuse me. What I'm going to discuss today are essentially three primary areas of our arguments. The question or the issues regarding the nature and scope of the technology at issue, the question of the copyright owner's likelihood of success on contributory infringement, and the likelihood of success regarding vicarious liability. I do not intend to discuss, unless the court has questions, some of the other arguments raised, such as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, safe harbor provisions, or other arguments we've raised regarding the scope of the preliminary injunction issued by the district court. First, I'd like to discuss the technology, which from our standpoint appears to have been the source of a great deal of confusion both among the copyright owners and the district court. Contrary to the copyright owner's suggestion, both below and here, the Aimster system, as it's called, is not one big integrated group or one big integrated form of technology. What we have are two separate software products that were distributed separately, several websites, the two most prominent ones being www.aimster.com and www.clubaimster.com, the private messaging software, which we, as we refer to in our brief, was available for download from the Aimster.com site, as well as some other sites that would distribute free software. And the Club Aimster software was distributed from the
Club Aimster. Is it correct if someone pushes the play, clicks on play, that will then download the song? For the record?
Well, what Club Aimster was...
Well, yes or no, then you can explain.
It may, depending...
Well, come on now, what does that mean? You're going to explain the technology, you can't answer a simple question?
Yes, it will.
Okay.
And if I can now explain in certain circumstances. The Club Aimster listing of top 40 files was compiled by mining anonymous user data, in which Mr. Deep was able to identify identical files through the use of hash
files. I didn't understand. I thought your argument was that because these files, these music files, these songs are encrypted, you don't have any idea whether these are copyrighted works that are being distributed. But how then did you compile your top 40 list? You must know what music is being transmitted.
Well, again, first of all, let me say that the inability to determine anything about the files being transferred is very applicable to the private messaging software, which was separate from the Club Aimster software. With regard to the Club Aimster software, what Mr. Deep was able to do was identify identical files through the use of hash sums, and then compile statistics concerning, he would then apply what he called in some deposition testimony in a previous lawsuit that's been made part of this record, a, for the lack of a better term, a Dewey decimal number to the files that were identical. He would then be able to compile statistics based on the activities users engaged in regarding each of these particular identical files and ranked them accordingly. The names in the top 40 list were, is my understanding, simply the names from the first file that that Mr. Deep received or that Amster somehow received, that was used as the name in the top 40 list.
And that file revealed the name of the song, didn't it? I mean, if someone went to Club Angster, you didn't just say number one song in a blank. Didn't it identify it? You know.
The titles of the files, if I recall from looking at the Club Angster screenshots, were identical or similar to songs. One of the points that Mr. Deep has tried to make is that the fact that a file does not, the fact that a file has a name that is similar or identical to a music file does not necessarily mean it is that music file, because there were people out there that would publish files using a particular name, but it would have advertisements for businesses, web pages, all kinds of things like that, trying to find people who would download that file by virtue of the name looking like a song. That answers Court's question. So the name of the song, the name of a song might appear, but it did not necessarily mean that that was that the file was the song. It may be the song, it may not be the song. It was just simply a name given by someone at some point to a file that was placed into the peer-to-peer software, the peer-to-peer exchange network. The private, getting back to the private messaging software, which again was separate from the Club Amster software. The private messaging software was available for download from various places. It provided encrypted instant messaging, encrypted file transfers, encrypting chat capabilities. It also allowed users to view the...
What's the purpose of encrypting the music files that are shared among the buddies?
Well, as both sides have recognized, it's not just music files that are shared. This is a technology that allows the sharing of any kind of files, not simply music files.
But this buddy system is designed not to identify an actual buddy, someone you might want to have a confidential conversation with. It's to simply identify someone who possesses a particular piece of music. So for that function that your service provides, what is the purpose of encryption?
The buddy system, I would respectfully disagree with regard to the purpose of the buddy system or the search. The buddy system was set up to allow users to form buddy groups. Users could also search the user profiles of non-buddies, and in part of a it's not called a buddy group.
What is the purpose of encryption?
So, well, the purpose of encryption would be...
What's the privacy interest or property interest that you're trying to protect with encryption?
The privacy interest is the secure communication, which would include the exchange of files, be they music files or Word document files, photos.
Well, what is the evidence there's anything except music files exchanged through your system?
Mr. Daniel, the copyright owner's expert, acknowledges that this system, unlike Napster's, would exchange any kind of file.
Yes, I know, but what's the evidence that anything actually exchanged is not a music file?
Well, the evidence put in the record from the copyright owners consisted solely of file names that appeared to be music files. Again, those were not all.
That's their evidence. Where's your evidence?
The evidence that that other types of music files were exchanged came in the form of Mr. Deep's declaration, in which he did not specify particular files and did not provide long list of screenshots, but in which he said that on several different occasions the system was not only capable of exchanging non-music files, but also was in fact used for that purpose.
How does he know?
He, I assume, knows by using the software.
Well, I know he knows it's capable of transmitting other stuff. How does he know that his service is actually used for other than copyrighted music?
Well, he could go on, he could sign on as any other Aimster user could, do a user profile search, join a buddy group, and download files, some of which may be copies of music, some of which may be copies of other types of just other kinds of files, non-music files.
You say he could do that.
I believe he did. I don't.
What do you mean, you believe he did? Is that in the record?
I don't recall whether his declaration states that he actually did that or whether.
I don't really understand your conception of contributory infringement. Is it your view that someone can set up an encrypted system, advertise it as a means of sharing copyrighted music, and then say, well, there's no contributory infringement because as a result of encryption, I don't actually know whether or what copyrighted music is being distributed. Is that your position?
It is, except to the extent that if there are particular activities of the defendant that constitute inducement or other like kinds of activities that would rise to the level of contributory infringement, then those kinds of activities.
You certainly have that here. You have advertising. Clearly, it's being presented as a music sharing service. Most of the music is copyrighted. So, what more do you need for contributory infringement?
Well, I would point back to the Supreme Court statement in Sony that the mere providing of a product and advertising that product for a particular use, and I believe it.
So what more would be necessary to find contributory infringement here? Or
well,
does the encryption render it impossible?
No, I don't think the encryption renders it impossible. To find contributory infringement with regard to what we consider to be a staple product, something that has substantial non-infringing uses, one can do something beyond mere advertising that directs the end user to, in a more active and knowledgeable way, to commit infringement. And I say that by looking to analogous principles in patent law from which the contributory infringement rules regarding staple, non-staple products have been derived.
Let me ask you this. You rely on Sony quite a bit, trying to argue that Aimster is and the services they provide are more like an article of commerce. But when we look at the facts in your case, perhaps a cable or a modem might be akin to an article of commerce. Why should the services that Aimster provides fall into that category?
Well, I don't suggest that the services that they provide necessarily fall into that category. The provision of software.
Well, the software. Why should it fall into that category?
Software Sony has been applied to software distribution by at least two other court of appeals, the Ninth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, and at least in areas outside of this, this court has acknowledged, as many courts have acknowledged, that software is a good under the UCC. There's little from the rationale of Sony that would suggest that because something is intangible, it is outside the scope of Sony's staple, non-staple distinction.
Yeah, but a lot of that software in those other cases had other uses, and the defendants were able to show that. You haven't been able to answer adequately, I don't think, Judge Posner's question in terms of proof that this was used for non-copyrighted material. I mean, isn't that a distinction drawn in those other cases?
Yes, the particular substantial non-infringing uses, I can point to two very specific ones for the private messaging software. One is that it has the capability of providing secure instant messaging and secure file transfer of any kind of file.
Well, how is it secure? Can't anyone who subscribes to your service decrypt and receive?
As I understand it, when someone would subscribe to the service, there were various choices in terms of buddy groups that they could join. Several people could create their own buddy group, people that you knew. The four of us could create our own buddy group. There were other broader buddy groups based on interest, shared interest. There was
you just go online and you say you want X music, and then anybody who subscribes to this service can decrypt your message, and if he wants, can send you the music. Isn't that true?
No, in the sense that the find a buddy capability allowed users to search other user profiles, mm-hmm. Including people not within their buddy group. If they tried to download a song or a file that was not from someone not part of the buddy group, they would receive an encrypted file with which they could not decrypt because they did not have the encryption key. So you could look to see who has what, but you couldn't necessarily decrypt what you got because the person that you selected had to be part of your buddy group.
But then couldn't you just join that buddy group?
Perhaps. It's not an open invitation to everybody. For instance, again, if the four of us were in a buddy group, someone couldn't simply enter our buddy group and without our consent. And there were other buddy groups formed, and I don't have the list of the different options for buddy groups memorized, but a number of the buddy groups were formed by individual users grouping together, people that either knew each other previously or did not know each other previously but decided to form a buddy group.
And so, but I thought that you could download songs without being in a buddy group.
No.
Perhaps I misread that.
I don't believe that's the case.
So you have to be in a buddy group in order to download.
You have to have, yes, and to be in a buddy group, well, when you're in the buddy group, you have the same decryption key that the other people in the buddy group have.
Well, what do you have to do to join a buddy group? Or how do you do it?
When registering for the software, when downloading the software and registering to participate in this, there were various options made available, is my understanding. I never did.
Well, all right. What's an option? What is one of the options?
One of the options, I believe, was to create your own buddy group.
I don't know why you're so vague about this. It's kind of important. You don't know what they were?
Well, I didn't anticipate this being...
Well, wasn't that part of what was in the tutorial? I mean, the tutorial gave a step-by-step guide on how you could download this material. So, didn't that explain how you get into the buddy group?
Yes, I believe it does. And I apologize. I didn't.
Well, suppose what you want to do, you want to share music. You want to get music that you don't own, and you're willing to, you know, upload the music you do own. So now, what is the option that a person like that would select?
Well,
I don't want to talk to these people. I just want to get music.
There were, I believe, options to join buddy groups of shared interests of different types.
Popular music or teenage music, whatever
that
is.
That may have been one of them. I don't recall.
So there were categories on the site of the type of music you wanted. So you didn't have to identify a person you wanted to be a buddy group. You just hit the category of music, and that would put you in that buddy group, correct?
That would be one way to put it. Another way to put it would be this was a group of folks with shared interest beyond music. I mean, there were different, I believe there were different buddy groups beyond simply music genres.
Well, can you give us examples of that?
No, again, I apologize. I don't have the tutorial or the information in front of me, and I didn't realize this would be such a crucial issue to the court. I do know that there is a wide variety of options for joining different kinds of buddy groups. It was not, as the copyright owner suggests, a situation where you join the entire crowd and have.
But you could.
You could search the user profiles of the entire crowd, but if you clicked on a particular file.
What's the broadest, well, you probably don't know, but what is the broadest category, the biggest buddy group that you can join?
Your Honor, I asked my client that recently. He didn't recall, and I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Montague. Mr. Fraxton?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Russell Frackman, and I represent the appellees. If I may, I'd like to respond to the court's most recent questions. Everybody is your buddy when you're on Teamster, certainly if you want everybody to be your buddy. And I would refer to the court to, among other things, Exhibit 1 to Ms. Forrest's declaration in support of the preliminary injunction motion, and it was on page 13 where there is a screenshot, Teamster info, and it says, this is the tutorial, by the way, that Your Honor referred to. Be sure to check Find Teamster Buddies in your settings, or else you will only search your buddies. So all you have to do is check Teamster Buddies. That is crystal clear. Everybody is your buddy, and everybody, no pun intended, I guess, everybody's buddy receives the information unencrypted. The only one who purportedly can't see it is Mr. Deep. The music is not encrypted. The searches are not encrypted. You search in the English language for a recording or a song, you get back search results in the English language for a recording or a song. To the users, the use is seamless and unencrypted. And therefore, Judge Posner, there is no privacy interest as far as we can tell. The only person who is not seeing what is going on is the person who doesn't want to see what's going on, Mr. Deep. To respond to another series of the court's questions, if I may, there was no evidence in the record of any non-infringing use. Judge Aspin specifically made that finding in his opinion. The only evidence in the record was of overwhelming infringing use of the most egregious type, the top 100 recordings, for example, in Billboard, top 10 recordings for the last 10 years. Mr. Deep did not provide to the court that which we provided to the court, actual screenshots from use of the system showing what it was doing. What we provided to the court were hundreds, probably thousands of pages of screenshots showing infringement. There wasn't a single screenshot, single piece of evidence showing the use of the Aimster system for non-infringement. Third, if I may, I'd like to respond to...
Let me just go back.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there were no hits you got that showed something other than a song. In other words, one of the arguments he made was, you know, it could be ads, it could be used in some other format or what...
Mr. Creighton's declaration, now, Your Honor, we searched for specific recordings. As Your Honor knows, the recordings listed on the schedules to the complaints several times. The recordings in Billboard Top 100, Top 10 recordings, Gold recordings, so on. And we found essentially all of them, and that is in Mr. Creighton's series of declarations, I believe, and submitted to the court. Now, on this issue, Your Honors, of what the business is of Aimster, Aimster is one business. It is, of course, epitomized by Club Aimster, but it is one business and is designed to do essentially one thing, and that is infringe copyright. And Mr. Deep's declaration itself, I think, maybe inadvertently at the time, explains that. This is the declaration that Mr. Deep submitted in opposition, one of them. The court permitted Mr. Deep to submit three separate declarations, as Your Honors know. The declaration that he submitted in opposition to the preliminary injunction, I think it was his first declaration, filed January 28, 2002. At paragraph 21, here's what he says, if I may. Plaintiffs make much of the existence of Club Aimster, which lists 40 of the most popular songs that have been searched using Aimster. This is merely reporting to Aimster users the popularity of individual songs. It is not a directory. Those individuals who wish to listen to songs, and listen is a euphemism here for download, because as Your Honor pointed out, when you click on play in Club Aimster, you get a copy of the recording. But Mr. Deep goes on to say, and I'm quoting again, those individuals who wish to listen to songs listed on Club Aimster must still click onto a search request of the song title, which then connects the user to the Aimster service. It's one business model, one seamless business model. But what Club Aimster does do, Your Honors, is very important to understanding that business model, as Judge Aspin did. It does a couple of things that are very important, I would submit to the court, and in this way epitomizes the entire system. First of all, it gathers from Aimster users, and these come from all Aimster users, and that's in Mr. Deep's deposition that we submitted to the court. It gathers from all Aimster users the songs that they download most often. So it identifies those songs and gathers them. Not only does it identify the songs or the recordings, it identifies frequently the record label, the position on the Billboard chart, the recording artist, and other identifying information. Second, on the other end of the system's operation, it then connects one user to another user who has that recording, which then proceeds to download to the requesting user.
How many users or customers did Aimster have at its peak?
In the record, Your Honor, we had a couple of pieces of information that indicated reports that indicated anywhere between 2 and I believe 3.5 million users. Those were attached. They were press reports attached to Mr. Creighton's original declaration that were in evidence.
Now, what is being shared here is individual songs. Is that correct?
It's individual.
Or entire CDs.
Well, you could aggregate an entire CD if you selected it. You could presumably search for an entire CD if it was one file in a user's directory. You could do it song by song, recording by recording. You could do it recording by recording and aggregate an entire CD, or you could do it by CD and see if there were was a user online who had the entire CD in one file. All of those were certainly possible. Now, Your Honor, there's one...
What is your conception of contributory infringement? How would you formulate your test for it?
Well, I think the test that I would formulate is the one that has been used by the courts, as Your Honor knows, for many, many years. And that is someone who materially contributes to the infringement with knowledge. Now, the material contribution can be...
Well, that doesn't really fit Sony, though, right? There was certainly material contribution to infringement with knowledge. So doesn't Sony suggest quite a narrow conception of contributory infringement?
No, Your Honor. I think Sony suggests, I would suggest, a very narrow, limited defense to contributory infringement. A defense that applies based on the facts of Sony, and as Your Honor knows, Sony was a very fact-intensive opinion by the Supreme Court, citing frequently to the district court's findings of fact. Sony applies in a situation where the copyrighted material was transmitted for free over the air, over the free broadcast airwaves, by the copyright owner.
That's irrelevant. They make their money by... Their concern is with stripping the advertising. So clearly there is infringement if you strip away the advertisements.
Well, as the Sony court determined, as found by the district court in Sony, there was no evidence of harm, that type of harm or any other harm, to the copyright owners in Sony.
Well, no evidence of harm here either.
Oh, yes, there is, Your Honor, I would submit.
Well, there's nothing in here about how, you know, music industry sales have suffered as a result of Aimster.
The evidence that we have before the court, as Your Honor knows, are several declarations from the record industry representatives indicating their intent and, in fact, their participation in this emerging market, a key market for downloading. The fact that the provision of the very same music to the very same users in the very same format is inhibiting that entry into that market. Second, what we had before the court from the record industry owners was the fact that only 1 out of 10 recordings makes any money, recoups its money. That one recording out of 10.
It's always been true, hasn't it? Nothing new.
It has been true, Your Honor, but what happens here in the Aimster system is they are picking off those very recordings that are making the money. That's the Aimster Top 40. That's where our clients make their money in order to finance their business and continue their business.
That is true in Sony. It would be the most popular programs that are copied, that are taped, and then, you know, taped without the advertising.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that was not the fact in Sony. The fact in Sony was that a program was being taped to be time-shifted, as
well,
Your Honor knows.
Sometimes. And sometimes it was just taped in order to get rid of the advertising. Fast forward, which was considerably provided by Sony. So, I mean, I'm just saying your formulation, it's a very difficult question, what exactly contributory negligence, contributory infringement amounts to, but the way you formulate it, materially facilitating infringement with knowledge that infringement will occur is exactly what was the case in Sony.
Well, no, Your Honor, again, respectfully, I think there are two aspects. I would analyze it in this way. I would submit to the court that the definition of contributory infringement that I provided to the court is the traditional definition. You then overlay the Sony limited defense, which involves...
That's a very creative reading of Sony, but it's not the atmosphere of the opinion. After all, the court says that if some device, and it could be a service as well as a product, is capable of substantial non-infringing uses, then it's not contributory infringement. So I think you have to fit this Amster case to that. Of course, their argument is, well, this kind of chat room file sharing business could be used for non-infringing uses, even if it isn't.
My response to that, Your Honor, would be, using Your Honor's formulation, Sony is, on the other hand, not a license to build an infringing business, which is what they did here. The fact that it could be used but is not being used for a non-infringing right. purpose is far outside the context of Sony, which, as Your Honor knows, not only talked about a substantial non-infringing use but a substantial commercial non-infringing use. So my first response would be to fit this case, and Sony was an issue, as Your Honor knows, before Judge Aspin, to fit this case into the Sony construct, I would say, first of all, that this is the Amster system and service is not an article of commerce. We argue that.
I don't see that, because if you take the AOL instant messaging service, that can certainly be used for file sharing, for music file sharing. It can be used to infringe. But you wouldn't want to argue that AOL was guilty of contributory infringement by providing this service, which is not a product, but a service, which can, however, be used for this file sharing.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, as your Honor knows, that the AOL, small aspect of the AOL service and issue compared to the business model of Amster presents a grossly different issue, number one. Number two, I would submit that it is not a commercially significant aspect of it. And number three, I would submit to the court that what we have in AOL is a paradigm of what the DMCA safe harbor was designed to deal with. AOL is essentially an internet service provider providing internet access, exactly what Amster does not do.
Well, Amster doesn't provide the access, but it is an interstate. It is an internet service provider. It's providing an internet service.
It's
a service, but that's what it is.
It is providing, under the broad definition, as Judge Aspin found, although I believe no other court has so found, it fits within the definition of an internet service provider under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. As Your Honor knows, there are various reasons, as Judge Amster found, why Amster would not be entitled to the safe harbor. If I can return to the court's Sony question for a moment. In addition to the fact, the staple article of commerce issue, the article issue as opposed to the service, where there is, this is not just a service in name, it is an ongoing relationship, updating, providing Club Amster, providing connectivity, resuming broken transmissions, circumventing firewalls. Second, it is not capable, the Amster system is not, I would submit in the definition of the United States Supreme Court, capable of a substantial non-infringing use because, among other things, as the Supreme Court says, at least in one aspect of the opinion and other courts have followed, that use has to be commercially significant, and there is no commercially significant use in the record here beyond infringement. Beyond that, I would submit to the court that, as Judge Aspin found, there are several policy as well as legal reasons why Sony does not and ought not apply here. Sony was, as I argued to the court, decided in a particular factual context.
I know what you mean by saying Sony doesn't apply. I mean, clearly it's a different case, and this is a much stronger case for you, obviously, but that doesn't mean the standard of Sony is inapplicable.
You're correct, Your Honor, and I don't disagree with that. Certainly, Sony was an issue before the district court and is an issue on appeal. What I meant to say was that Sony does not provide a defense under the particular facts and circumstances present here, where you have the primary, indeed, as far as the record is concerned, the only use to be infringing, where what has been created by Mr. Deep as a global distribution system, not making copies for time-shifting purposes that are then erased, where you have a business that was made especially to infringe, advertised, encouraged, in Judge Aspin's words, enticed users to infringe.
I'd like to ask you a question about vicarious infringement. I can see what work vicarious infringement does in a case like this. It seems to me it's contributory infringement, but it's not. Can you imagine a chain of reasoning by which a court could find that there was not contributory infringement here, but there was vicarious infringement?
I suppose that one could find, although I'm not picturing it in my mind at the moment, a system that was not implemented as a business model for profit, and thereby avoid vicarious infringement. I suppose, in theory, although I'm not a technologist, one could come up with a system where there is absolutely no either legal or practical ability to control the system.
Now, I can see cases where there's contributory infringement without vicarious. It's the reverse I have trouble seeing. What, at least in the context of this case, I can imagine other cases, but what would be a case, how could this case be vicarious infringement but not contributory infringement?
In this case, Your Honor, given the facts of this case...
What do you gain by having vicarious infringement in here?
I don't know at the end of the day, as I told Judge Aspin at oral argument, that in terms of remedy, relief, or damages, there was anything to be gained. They simply were, in the context of this case, two legal theories that frequently, as Your Honor knows, are pleaded and proven together, and that we thought applied here. The remedies that we would request in terms of injunctive relief and in terms of damages would essentially be the same. However, I think it is important in the context of this case that because I believe we have proven a substantial likelihood of success on the merits on both of those claims, that the court deal with and affirm, this court respectfully deal with and affirm on both of those theories, because I think in this particular instance they both apply. There may be other situations that one could conceive of downstream where they might not, but I think this court's guidance on both of those issues in this particular case would be very helpful in terms of that guidance. And I think in this particular case, on these facts and on the law, Judge Aspin should be affirmed on both theories of contributory and vicarious infringement.
But wouldn't you agree that if we find contributory infringement, we don't even have to get to vicarious infringement?
We
don't need to reach that. I mean, I see that as a fallback position, as just another count in the complaint, you know, for thorough coverage. And do we really even have to reach that?
I
understand you would like to have something on it because you'd like something in writing on it from the court, but the reality is we wouldn't even have to reach that.
The answer to that, Your Honor, is of course you're correct. I see my time has expired.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Frackman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
in your time had expired, Mr. Cronin. So we thank both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement, and court will take a brief